Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The Trump administration is proposing a nearly 25% cut to NASA's budget, as well as deep cuts to space technology funding. Opponents of these proposed cuts say they would undermine U.S. leadership in space and threaten valuable scientific advances. For example, the Coalition for Deep Space Exploration says the budget threatens our scientific capabilities, jeopardizes a sustained human presence on the moon, undermines U.S. leadership in space, and would make NASA's exploration goals nearly impossible. We're going to talk about this today with Casey Dreyer, who's Chief of Policy at the Planetary Society, and Christopher Kokinos, Logan-based nature and science writer and professor emeritus of English. Welcome in first on Zoom, Casey Dreyer with the Planetary Society. Thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So, Casey, you head up, policy, also strategic planning for a space policy and advocacy program, degree in physics and concentration in astronomy from Oberlin College. Also, you host a podcast, I'm reading.
I do. The Space Policy Edition for anyone who wants to really dive into the deep issues here, which I'm happy to do, but we can wade in gently today.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good. Christopher Kokinos is, as I said, Utah-based science writer whose latest book, Still Is Bright, which we've talked about in this program, is about the moon. Also includes coverage of the Artemis Return to the Moon NASA program, as well as historical context about Apollo. Still Is Bright was a finalist for Utah Book Award. It was named to a Best of Book list last year. And Christopher Kokinos writes about space, science, NASA, and Artemis for Astronomy Magazine, Discover.com, Esquire, Los Angeles Times, and Space News. And we welcome you into the program.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's great to have a deeper dive into some of these issues, which are looming right now.
Yeah. So this particular cut, I'll start with you, Casey Dreyer. This is not so much DOGE, as this is a proposed budget. I guess official budget from the president's administration. Give me an outline, and I'll turn to CRISPR for this as well, of just the basics, the cuts.
So I think just broad context is I'll start with here. So, you know, right now NASA represents roughly 0.3% of all U.S. spending every year. So it's already very tiny. This cut is an top line cut of 25%. And again, historical context, that is the largest single year cut to NASA in its entire history since the beginning of the start of the space age. If this goes through, adjusting for inflation, this would be NASA's smallest budget since the winter of 1961. So before the first US astronaut even went into space. A lot has changed in space since 1961. Those cuts are not applied evenly, though they are broad. They are primarily directed at NASA's scientific activities. These are the robotic spacecraft like the Hubble Space Telescope, the missions like Voyager that are now visited the outer planets, now in interstellar space, or the rovers on Mars. These are targeted for being cut by half, with various levels of the specific disciplines being cut, sometimes even more. And that, you know, is a functional, obviously historic, but also dramatic change, right? That is in one single year, losing half of your operating income and activities, you have to end a lot of things. So we're looking at turning off active missions. We're looking at ending projects that are on time and on budget. And we're looking at a fundamental, in a sense, profoundly different relationship of U.S. leadership or lack thereof in space as a consequence. This does try to direct a lot more activity towards a Mars program for humans, implicitly supporting the SpaceX concept of using, you know, sending humans to Mars via their large Starship rocket, moving away from major projects like the Space Launch System with the solid rocket boosters made here in Utah, and winding that down in favor of commercial entities filling in that gap. So it's a major proposal. And I think what's also important context here again is that this is actually not coming from a considered policy process in the White House. No one actually seems to know who is in charge of space policy right now. This appears to be a primarily budget-driven decision by the White House's budget office, which is not really taking into account, I would even argue, the president's larger vision for space exploration and American leadership therein.
Christopher Kokinos, this would essentially end a program started by the Trump administration. I think one of the things that it would
threat. That's right. And one of the things that we can talk about, and Casey would be the expert on this too, is that as he just said, we can pick up on this. This budget proposal coming from the White House, but not entirely clear who, and at a time when we don't even have an administrator in place at NASA. But yes, the Artemis program would end after two more missions. Artemis 2 is set to fly sometime between February and May of next year, or sometime in the spring of next year. That crew is actively training. Their capsule is built. The rocket has been assembled. Other hardware for Artemis is being bent, as engineers say. Things are in process and in production. We can talk about Northrop Grumman here in Utah in a moment as well. They build part of that rocket. So indeed, the Trump administration, under the leadership of Vice President Pence, who headed the National Space Council, proposed this return to the moon, this human return to the moon. And now there's this furious backpedaling to end that process after a couple of missions. Now, it's unclear if there's a sense that there would be some version of that proceeding, but it certainly seems like this would be sort of pulling the carpet out from under a program that would get humans to the moon. And why that is important is really there are two fundamental reasons. One's geopolitical. China is interested in going there as well, and other countries. And the U.S. has a large coalition of international partners, some 55 nations in the Artemis Accords. And the return to the moon is being driven by science and also by an interest in commerce, which is the discovery of water ice in the polar regions of the moon. If you can find water, you can study it. You can understand the early history of the solar system. It's a scientific archive, so there's that drive, that sense of curiosity. The moon is not a boring place, as Carl Sagan once said famously, I think back in the 1960s. It's actually a very fascinating and dramatic companion satellite to our planet. We can learn a lot there, and we could do a lot of good science. But if you have water, you can make rocket fuel. You can drink that water. You can have oxygen. So there's a sense that Artemis was, and I hope will still be, this first effort at a sustained presence on the moon. Unlike Apollo, which was just, you know, in some sense planting the flag, leaving footprints, and then, you know, we haven't been back in more than 50 years.
And we haven't spent a whole lot of time on the moon.
No, we have spent very little time on the moon, less than 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, you'll hear scientists and engineers say, well, you know, we've been to the moon, been there, done that, but that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the moon's only one part of a vast vast space, right? Casey Dreyer, I want to just parenthetically talk about Elon Musk for a little bit here. You know, we don't know. We don't even have an administrator. We don't know where the budget's coming from, you're saying. I guess you could posit that the administration would maybe want to do Elon Musk a solid for all his work on Doge and everything. Does this budget favor SpaceX?
It certainly does in a lot of ways, not explicitly. So there is real context and nuance here that I think it's reasonable to be concerned about, that given the relationship, obviously, and kind of dealing that is potentially at play here. The other aspect of it, though, just taking Elon Musk out of the conversation for a second, SpaceX is just an incredible company. And so when, you know, if they do shift towards like, oh, we're going to have commercial companies help get us to Mars, that will benefit SpaceX because they're just head and shoulders above pretty much any other commercial space company out there. Now, is that an explicit quid pro quo? I don't, not necessarily, but obviously it does benefit them. However, I think just to add some, again, context to this, Elon Musk even tweeted, if that's what you call it these days, even tweeted online after seeing these reports of even the budget cuts to NASA and NASA science, like, wow, this seems like a bad idea, I'm paraphrasing. So even Elon Musk thinks that the science cuts are bad. And then he said, I can't be involved in budget decisions due to my conflicts of interest. So, you know, if we take him at that word, then, you know, clearly he thinks this is not great. Jared Isaacman, who is the nominee for NASA, who was clearly Elon Musk's kind of personal pick, he was himself a billionaire, had just testified before the Senate saying science is great at NASA, we need to do more of it. So this seems to not be coming from them in that sense. This seems to be, again, this is actually very consistent. The person who runs the White House's budget office, his name is Russ Vought. he actually published a document 3 years ago outlining, if I was in charge, here's what I would do functionally. And within that document, among all the other things that was in that document, was like, I'm going to cut NASA science by 50%. That was 3 years ago, right? So this is actually, to me, his policies being filtered through the White House and the president's policies. And not, again, 3 years ago, a lot has changed even in 3 years. Clearly not responsive to any developments on the ground or the current situation that we're facing. So there is an opaque policy decision process in the White House. There's lots of opportunities for conflict of interest. However, even things that Elon Musk says are bad seems to still be happening in space. And Elon Musk actually, I mean, or SpaceX stands to lose through these cuts, not just to NASA science, but also there are major cuts to the International Space Station that would reduce the number of astronauts on the station, reduce the amount of science that they do, and also reduce the amount of flights that they take into space. That's all money in SpaceX's pocket. So SpaceX actually stands to lose out on a lot of business by these cuts as well. So again, this is a budget that no one actually defends this from a policy perspective. This is just getting caught up in this larger discussion. It is a budget, again, of retrenchment and retreat, fundamentally gussied up in this idea. You mentioned that the universe is bigger than the moon. It is. It's huge. And there's so much to look and see. But this is a budget that says, no, the universe is the moon and Mars and mostly Mars, and that's it, and nothing else. And it's a very narrow view of what is literally the largest thing that we can conceive of the cosmos.
And, I would add to that as well, just a few more details in this budget proposal. And we can, Casey would be the expert on this, talk about budgeting and how dysfunctional that has become in Congress. But this, again, is a proposal from the White House. So we would eliminate Artemis, the return to the moon program that the president started in his first administration with hardware already, in development. Gateway, which is an orbiting lunar station. That is actually really, would be a great testing ground for deep space missions. We don't have the technology or the expertise. I think everybody in the space community, from reporters to policy people, would say it's too early to be thinking about going to Mars in this way. Gateway would be a test ground, this small station orbiting the moon. Two units of that have already been built. Gateway would be eliminated. The Space Launch System, which has been over budget, absolutely, and has been delayed, but is the only deep space and human-rated heavy launch vehicle that can get us to the moon and to Mars. That would be eliminated. There's no viable alternative yet. Starship keeps blowing up. The Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is already built, which is finishing testing and ready to launch, would be mothballed. There would be a 50% cut to technology research. And as often is the case in these budget proposals, the STEM programs at NASA, the educational outreach that reaches hundreds of thousands, millions of students around the country and around the world, that would be eliminated as well. And in the budget proposal from the White House, it's called, quoting, woke STEM education, which I don't fully understand how math can, fall into that sort of category. So there are a lot of cuts in this proposal that just don't seem to make a lot of sense.
And if I can jump on that,
yes.
Because this is stuff that really impacts, we can just bring it to Utah, right? I mean, it's easy when we talk about NASA to think about, you're putting a bunch of money on top of a rocket and shooting it off into the universe and you'll never see it again. That money is being spent here in Utah, in the United States, everywhere, right? On average, NASA spends about $335 million per year in Utah. The STEM education that Chris just mentioned, that funds Utah Space Grant. That gives small, single-digit thousands, is for interns. It provides money for robotics clubs in schools around the state. It allows students at BYU to have a rocketry team or to try to launch a CubeSat on International Space Station. These are things that would go completely away. And these are, the STEM education stuff is tiny. Small potatoes of small potatoes, right? That would just deny people the opportunity to get a foothold into the types of things that we say as a nation we want to do. Remain a leader in science, remain a leader in technology. But I'd say more broadly and ambitiously, what type of country are we? Are we looking out? Are we looking up? Are we trying to see and develop and learn things that are new, or are we turning inwards? And, you know, we can maybe go into this bigger picture thing later, but I do see this as symbolically really troubling in addition to the actual practical effects. The scientific impacts are broadly throughout the state. These are also, you know, again, Northrop Grumman is the largest, you know, billions of dollars of contracts that are at risk of going away. But there's hundreds of other companies and organizations and institutions in this state that stand to lose very significant amounts of support, particularly because they specialize in areas that are really targeted in this. Earth science, instrumentation development, things called heliophysics, right? Studying the sun, studying how the sun's mass ejections can impact the Earth's magnetic field, which is solar storms that can impact our electrical grid, communication satellites, national security satellites. All the things that Utah specializes in actually are kind of randomly very much at risk and targeted very specifically here. So you would see more than just like a 25% impact to Utah's income from NASA. It would be much greater because of its relationship to these targeted programs.
Yeah, and I just want to, you know, say that that Utah context very much includes Utah State University. It includes BYU. It includes the University of Utah, a number of private sector companies, and that includes Oxion Energy in North Salt Lake. So these are real people at real places, and that also in that equation, of course, at USU is the Space Dynamics Laboratory, which it's like 73 million dollars worth of NASA money here. And the other part of this that I think listeners need to bear in mind is that the return on investment from NASA is really good. Like, it's a really good investment. For every dollar spent, $3 are generated in the economy. So that's money, in a sense, if these cuts were to go through, that's money taken out of the pockets of Utahns and people across the country.
Before we go to break, Casey Jarrett, I want to talk about some specifics here. Do we know if this proposed NASA budget is in the big, beautiful bill that's inching through Congress right now?
Those are two different types of bills, but they're related. So okay. The big, beautiful bill has something. This is Congress setting its own overall spending limits. And within that, doing a lot of other somewhat related taxing and taxes and other types of policy setting within that context. This is not the specific application of what's called appropriations, literally responding and giving money authorization to NASA to spend on various projects. But this is basically Congress tying their own hands, saying this is the amount of money we have to work with. NASA's pot of money comes from what's called discretionary spending. The United States has a lot, you know, again, spend about $5 to $6 trillion a year. 3/4 of that are things that are called mandatory: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, servicing our national debt, Medicare for medical care for veterans, and so forth. That's all written into law. That's not what Congress debates every year. The actual portion that funds NASA that you don't count as Department of Defense is 1/6, right? So, you know, 15%, right, of every dollar spent goes to everything else the government does. And of that, 1% goes to NASA, right? So it's just the slice of pie that NASA gets out of the overall budget pie, the pie as itself is shrinking. And that will make it harder for Congress to react, restore, support these projects that are targeted right now, even if, and I'll emphasize this, there is a broad support for this. Again, no one is coming out and saying, this is great. I can't wait to cut STEM funding from these rocket clubs, you know, in Utah that have really been living off the taxpayer dole for too long. And this is how we get fiscal responsibility back in this country. No one is supporting this, but it tends to be lost in this larger trends of how we're trying to spend money in the country or not, and what we spend that on and what we don't.
Christopher Kroukinos, do we know at all how our delegation, congressional delegation in Utah, is looking at this?
I don't. I reached out. I've reached out as others have. I have, you know, with my reporter hat on and as my private citizen hat on as well. I can tell you that, you know, the 1,600 jobs that are in Utah because of NASA, the $400 million of economic activity that's in Utah because of NASA, that will garner attention. But in Congress, there is a bipartisan caucus called the Planetary Science Caucus. And that has, I think, Casey could correct me, but I think about 80 to 90, again, Republicans and Democrats who have signed on saying, this proposed cut to NASA is unacceptable. But as of yesterday, I did not see anybody from the Utah congressional delegation that had signed on to that letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Casey Dreyer, I guess if people want to have an effect, call to your congressman. Probably the thing to do.
Yes, the most important thing. There's a great. I mean, when you talk about space, it's easily jumps up the awareness level. Not a lot of people talk about it, even though it is broadly popular. NASA is the second most popular federal agency in the country, right behind the post office. Has been that way for years. People generally like NASA, right? And when you talk to your member of Congress about it, it because it's less common, it jumps up their awareness. They say, why did five people call me today about this? What is happening here? They may not realize how much, and this is one of the reasons we try to put this data out there. A lot of even members of Congress don't even realize how much NASA impacts their states because they don't have a NASA center. But that doesn't mean you're not a space state. It's not just universities. These are school clubs. These are companies, these are small businesses all over the state and every state that has a lot to gain or lose from this, but also again, be part of something bigger. And this is so important to me is that NASA and what we do in space, Chris can talk about this in much more detail. Space though is just, it's a symbolic place of activity, right? Since we were cavemen, right? Or even before, we would look up and we would literally call this the heavens, something inaccessible, something different, something vast and unimaginable and powerful. And now we have the ability to do stuff there. So we're literally, NASA is our self-representation as a nation projected into the literal heavens. And that is an opportunity and has been classically for us to say, what is our best selves that we're bringing with us? Are we bringing curiosity? Are we bringing our tenacity and ambition? Are we bringing our desire to cooperate and go peacefully with our allies and other partners to seek out these types of things that we just have no idea what we're going to find that'll tell us more about our place in this cosmos in which we reside? And again, we don't and shouldn't spend all of our money doing this. It's a small, high-risk, high-reward investment like any good investment portfolio should have. That's what the space program is. And even, big cuts to small investments won't save you money, but they will have huge long-term consequences for the things that we don't do. And again, they reflect on us saying, here's what we choose to stop doing. We had the ability to go, and now we're saying we are no longer interested in doing so. And that's like a more fundamental tragedy to me.
I'd love to hear from you, Christopher, on this as well, that how we see ourselves, right? The power of the dream.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, we choose to go to space, and it is a choice. We choose to go to space, sending humans, sending robotic missions, putting telescopes up there that, beam down the James Webb, is just fascinating the internet because of these amazing pictures that take us nearly to the edge of the known universe and time. And we do this, and we pursue knowledge because curiosity is our evolutionary heritage. Now, Casey's absolutely right. Like, this is a national reckoning in a sense, right? So we can choose to be a nation either driven by curiosity or a nation comfortable with ignorance. And no nation comfortable with ignorance has thrived. Like, there's no sustainable future for that kind of country or that kind of society. So which will it be? And how do we put that question in the larger context, of course, of the choices that we make as a society with where we choose to spend our money? But I think the case is pretty clear that what we get functionally from NASA's return on investment and what we get in a sense philosophically is huge. And we make this choice. We're either driven by curiosity or we're comfortable with ignorance.
Hmm. I keep saying we're going to break. We'll go to break definitely after this. But you bring up a point, the larger point. Are we a nation that is comfortable with ignorance or do we want to push the bounds of knowledge? I would say there's a percentage an uncomfortably large percentage of Americans who seem to be comfortable with ignorance, seeking out ignorance, skeptical of experts. Sure. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, in a democracy, all voices are heard. All votes are cast and counted, and we can have that discussion. And I would just say to those who would, you know, sort of shrug their shoulders at cuts to NASA or the larger war on science, you know, a 50% cut to the National Science Foundation is also in this White House proposal. There's been already disruption at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes for Health. There's a larger war on science. This is kind of an anti-Sputnik moment. If you know what Sputnik is, great. If you don't, that was the Russian satellite that galvanized the United States in the late 1950s to make these investments in science education, in technology, in engineering. And we're the beneficiaries of that. So it doesn't matter, in a sense, if you want NASA to be eliminated or cut or you think SpaceX can do all of that, which it can't, you are the beneficiary of science and applied science, which is engineering and technological innovation. So we'll carry that water for you, in a sense. But I think that just on a very personal level, I'd like to take my telescope out on a sidewalk and show people the moon when it's up and it's clear in the, you know, beautiful Utah skies. And no one's talking about politics then. No one's, you know, talking about, you know, particular ideological affiliations. And that sense of wonder that comes from looking at the universe with clear eyes and having that sense of curiosity, that gets sparked. So I'd like to believe that that is still something that is part of our national psyche.
Mm-hmm. Casey Dreher, I'd like to get your idea on this broader question, war on science, you know, in combat with this very inspiring thought of we see ourselves in the universe, in space.
I mean, and this can't be seen without that context. And there is a larger, what I would call almost, it is a moral obscenity to attack fundamental research this way. And I would argue that it's a luxury to do so for all the reasons that Chris said, that we get to enjoy the fruits of 75 years of consistent investment in fundamental scientific discovery research, things that the private sector cannot or will not do because it's good for us. It is an enlightened perspective, but there's a very practical reason here too. The reason we do this at all, the United States really did not invest much as a country in scientific research until after World War II. There was a report that was provided to Eisenhower in his last months of his presidency by the head of MIT at the time that fundamentally laid out this argument. We have won World War II because of technology, because of things like radar, obviously nuclear weapons, but there's a broader capability, and then things like penicillin helping our warfighters in the field to heal, you know, people don't die of disease. And then more broadly, things like vaccines and otherwise, like, we are benefiting from this through the self-interest of a nation. And therefore, it is in the best interest of a nation to invest in things that we don't know the outcome of, because the potential values of what we may find are so massive that they will fundamentally protect the country. That was a sea change in how the United States had a relationship to fundamental science. And for the last 75 years, that has led us to enormous sustained improvements in health and well-being, in quality of life, and just fundamental expansion of so, we know so much more than we did when he wrote that report. And I think we're at a point where we have to, in a sense, make that argument again, because it has been so profoundly successful. Sometimes it's easy to step away and think that we don't need it anymore. We tried the experiment as a nation of letting the private sector exclusively do research, and it can do a lot of innovative research, but it tends to be focused on things that they can monetize and things that have a clear path to success, because most companies don't have the ability to just fundamentally spend time on things that they don't know the outcome of. This is why we have a public sector. And we ran that experiment for the first couple hundred, you know, 150 years of the country, and we fell behind in scientific discovery. We fell behind. We benefited from the exodus of trained scientists from Europe during the Nazi takeover in the 1930s and 40s. And we were able to leverage that and build on that and become the world leaders in technology. And to walk away from this, we may not see the consequences now. We may not see the consequences in 5 years, but we sure as hell will see the consequences in 10 to 15 to 20 years. And by that point, it'll take a generation to build it back. And so what I see in space is a sense that this, a symbolic aspect of this larger retreat from what has been the most successful and frankly, best return on investment. I mean, we talk again about overall all of science spending in the entire country is $60 billion a year-ish. That sounds like a lot of money, but again, that's out of $6 trillion, right? So we're spending roughly 1%. And we've gotten so much out of that. It's all of our health investment, cancer research, improvements for, you know, treatment, foodborne illnesses, you name it. And to walk away from that and to say it doesn't do anything or to say it's worth destroying it for other political reasons is a profoundly short-sighted and frankly heartbreaking perspective that does not see this larger picture of where we are now as a consequence of it. We learned that lesson the hard way in World War II. I don't want to learn that lesson the hard way again.
Let's do go to break. We're talking about proposed cuts of nearly 25% to NASA's budget, as well as even deeper cuts to space technology funding. And we're talking with Casey Dreyer, Chief of Policy at the Planetary Society, and Christopher Kokinos, a Logan-based writer and Professor Emeritus of English. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The Trump administration is proposing a nearly 25% cut to NASA's budget, as well as deep cuts to space technology funding. We're talking about this today with Casey Dreyer, Chief of Policy at the Planetary Society, and Christopher Kokinos, a Logan-based writer, Professor Emeritus of English. His latest book is about the moon. It's called Still as Bright. So let me start with you, Christopher Kokinos, on I guess the next topic here, which is the politics of this. Sometimes we like to have the Star Trek view, right? that we've overcome all political divisions, but we're not there yet, right?
No.
So if the U.S. cedes leadership position, I guess China is poised to be next.
Oh, very much so, and I know Casey can talk about this too. But China, in doing my reporting on Artemis and the future of human spaceflight in particular is of interest to me. The Chinese space program has taken, sorry for the pun, a great leap forward. I mean, they have done so much in such a short amount of time, and they are absolutely going to land humans at the lunar South Pole. Estimates vary, but, I wouldn't be surprised to see it in the next 5 or 6 years, roughly the same timeline that NASA has put out for itself. But inevitably, there are, delays. Going to space is hard. But China absolutely wants to establish with Russia and a few other partner nations, far fewer than the United States, a permanent base on the moon. And again, at that lunar South Pole region where that water ice is, and you can, again, use that for science, but you can certainly use that for rocket fuel, for oxygen, and for water. So that sustainable presence, if it comes first from China, what are the political implications there? We've seen that China doesn't particularly care about international law on this planet, and a number of people in the space law community are concerned about what a base like that would mean. And so just briefly to sum up here, if there's no territorial claim that you can make on the moon according to treaty, again, that could be set aside by the Chinese government, a U.S.-led coalition of 55 countries, the Artemis Accords, the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, Canada. I personally would like to see that happen first and establish a sense of fair, cooperative, safe procedures and norms rather than cede the lunar South Pole to China.
Casey Dreyer, same question to you. It's if U.S. pulls back, and U.S. has been in the lead since Sputnik, right?
Maybe since Apollo. I mean, we were kind of neck and neck with the Soviets for a while.
Okay, yeah, yeah. They were they were definitely in the lead with Sputnik, right? And then we caught up at some point. We've been the lead ever since. Talk about what that means, the importance of that, and then the threat to China. Poses.
Well, again, a lot of it is this, it's a geopolitical, it's a symbolic statement of capability. We've been in the lead in the sense that we have the most capability. Only the United States has sent missions and robotic spacecraft beyond Jupiter into deep part of the solar system. Only the United States has sent missions directly to the sun. It's surprisingly hard to get to. Only the United States has, until very recently, until China just did, landed projects on Mars. And only the United States has sent projects, you know, and spacecraft beyond the solar system into interstellar space. Now, an American, I take pride in that, but I think there's the values that the country, as we've done those, have tried to project in doing so, is, again, this kind of collaborative, peaceful, idealistic expression of our most, you know, cherished values. So this is where I go back to. Space is an opportunity for us to practice the best version of ourselves. And, you know, you see this in the astronauts that NASA, you know, how many PhDs do you have to be an astronaut, right? And you're a marathon runner, and you volunteer in the church choir or everything, right? These are the best of us. Same with our projects and missions, the way that we collaborate with countries around the world. These are expressions of our ideal selves. And if we, again, retreat from that and cede that, China is making massive investments in its space program, making massive investments in fundamental scientific education and training future scientists and engineers. And they have literally just announced projects to go to Mars and bring samples back, something that NASA was trying to do but is canceled in this budget, sending its missions out to the Uranus and Neptune in the deep space solar system, expanding these efforts, obviously, to land on the moon, and they're pursuing this methodical investment. It's not just China, though. India, Japan, the European Union, all of these other groups, they're making huge and increasing investments in space and science. And that tells me, too, for anyone who's just kind of skeptical about, is this something worth doing? Is this just are you just a special interest? You know, you're happy living off of a certain way, but now it's time to spend money somewhere else. Literally every other country in the world wants to have what we have now. In the United States, they're envious of our capabilities, the infrastructure, the talent pool. And this budget is the first step into destroying that for no real reason. And every other country is doing the opposite. That tells me that there is a fundamental value to this. And it should tell anyone who's skeptical about this, you know, I'm not convincing the Chinese or the Indians or any other nations, you know, to do this. They see this in their self-interest. And they're excited, a lot of them, particularly geopolitical rivals, that the U.S. seems about ready to, you know, essentially cut itself off at its kneecaps. Mm-hmm. So these are broad, important values. And if the United States isn't doing it, someone else will. And they'll leverage that to build stronger alliances themselves, to demonstrate to other nations how capable and reliable and profoundly technical the investments that they decide to make. Again, the symbolic expression here is just as important as the practical and spiritual aspects that we get from going out and learning what the universe is.
I would add to that, Tom and Casey, that recently the African Space Agency has formed, a continental space agency. And so we tend to think of these these efforts as largely the global north. But this is a global phenomenon. And I've been thinking recently about a mission that's largely forgotten. 50 years ago, 50 years ago in July, the Apollo-Soyuz test project occurred. And that was a joint mission, the first joint international mission between these two Cold War rivals. And so we're talking here about geopolitics and China. And yet, well, you mentioned Star Trek, you know, even the Federation and the Klingons don't get along very well, and then they do. Like, the, you know, we find these ways to accommodate and to cooperate and to create a different kind of future. That mission 50 years ago with the then Soviet Union ultimately led to this cooperative effort that we have, say, on the International Space Station. And so China is definitely a competitor, and they will certainly overtake us if this budget is passed. But why not also think more, toward this sense of cooperation as well? Will that happen anytime in the near future? I don't think so. But I just want to sort of point out that there's this sort of weird echo now of the Cold War rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States, and now it's the United States and our international partners and China. So, you know, that competition, you know, back in the 60s and 70s ultimately led to, you know, some joint ventures between these two rivals. It would be, I think, a hopeful sign and something that might temper China's disinterest in following international law. And, you know, maybe that's the door to something better.
I want to briefly set this in this particular budget discussion aside. I'm curious, as we've gone along with this discussion, I'll start with Casey Dreyer on this question. In an ideal world, if we didn't have these constraints and we didn't have to fight this budget, what should our priorities in space be? What give me 3 or 4 bullet points. What if you were czar of the space, Or I guess more quotidian, if you were the new administrator of NASA with Carte Blanche.
Casey would be a very good
administrator because they have to do what the president says.
So what should we be doing?
I think we actually had a really good plan. And you know, it is, if you'll forgive me just to bring the politics back a little bit, this isn't inherently a Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, or even fiscal conservative to, you know, a more government investment perspective here. NASA's plan that they put together under Trump's first administration is, in broad context, what I would do in the, you know, a sustained presence and pushing humans deeper out into space to learn how to live there, building the technology capability and economy, right, around that in order to sustain a broader group, not just governments, but commercial companies, individuals, bringing more people into space, bringing more countries together as allies in the national interest, then going on to Mars. NASA science hit its recent budgetary heights under the first Trump administration. And those types of missions, that's what I would invest in. I would say we're going to find everything we can. We're going to put all the effort we can into finding a sign of life, whether it's a communication or a biosignature detection in some atmosphere of an Earth-like planet, going to these ocean moons. We have worlds that are literally swimming with water, more water than liquid water than the Earth has, in our cosmic backyard around Jupiter and Saturn, that seem like if there's going to be a second genesis of life, it will be there. And why are we not there right now? Why do we not have a profound effort to say, does biology exist beyond Earth? And if it does, what does that tell us, not just about ourselves, but what will it tell us about our understanding of our own biology? And are there novel ways to create and sustain energy and life? And what does that tell us about medicine? And what does that tell us about how we can live better and healthier? These sustained efforts to bring students and to hoover up students from every corner of the country to say, you have an opportunity, no matter where you live, to do the most exciting, profound, meaningful work into expanding our understanding of the cosmos, into doing the hardest types of things possible to make a spacecraft survive in deep space or on the harsh, you know, windswept plains of Mars or under, you know, the crushing Venusian atmospheres. You will figure out how to do that. And then you go out and you make a life for yourself, figuring out where to apply those technologies and capabilities and skills. This is a generative activity. It is a turbocharge for our economy, it is a turbocharge for ideas, and it will stimulate our culture and our activities as a nation. If we just do more of that, if we give ourselves that excitement, it is the counterpoint to turning inwards and focusing on Instagram or TikTok. It's the equivalent. I keep thinking about this. This budget is the equivalent of hunching over a cell phone while you're standing at the rim of the Grand Canyon, looking at pictures of celebrities instead of looking up to what's actually in front of you. And this is a down and in budget. And I think we're better than that. that's not the country I want to be in, and that's not the country I want my children to grow up in. I want, and this space is that trigger point to say we can do anything. And that wrapping it around this big idea of, can we find life elsewhere? Can we find the most important discovery that humanity may ever make about itself? We have the capability to do it. We just are not doing it. So that's what I would do. And this is, again, it's not a partisan thing. And a lot of Republicans and Democrats think this is great and exciting and valuable. I can't emphasize enough that this is an extreme, highly minority position that is being projected out now under the guise of the president's policy proposals, but fundamentally undermines the president's own words and desires for space itself. This is an extremist minority position that is, again, just a pointless, disastrous implementation of something that we, frankly, is precious, that we've invested in, that is unique and very, very exciting that we do.
I, Casey gets metaphor of the morning awards with the phone at the Grand Canyon.
That is great.
I think that's that's spot on. I would just say a couple things. One, you know, President Biden continued these efforts. There was a lot of concern when in the space community, because NASA is a civic agency and it's answerable to the public through our elected representatives, that the Biden administration would radically change course. And it didn't. It continued Artemis. It built on Artemis and continued the approach that the first Trump administration had, as Casey so eloquently, you know, shared with us. So that, I think, should tell us something. And I was just thinking also about, you know, sort of bringing this back to Utah. Where do some NASA researchers go to study extremophiles, those, you know, tiny microbes that thrive in very hot, very salty, very difficult conditions? They go to places like Yellowstone. They go to the Great Salt Lake, and they do research here. And that inspires students, as Casey was saying, to go on and do, if not work in space science, other kinds of science, biology, medicine. You know, it's a force multiplier, studying space and the NASA budget. These things are force multipliers for good in all sorts of ways. And so those people who might prefer to, you know, look at flat Earth conspiracy theories or we never landed on the moon, you know, websites, they're using computers and cell phones that we can thank the space program for.
Well, we've reached near the end of the time, so give you a final word here, whatever you'd like to say, about a minute each. So Casey Dreyer first.
I'd say check out planetary.org, my organization. It's an independent organization. We don't get any, I always like to say, if all of my policies succeed, I don't get any bonus, right? We don't get any contracts. We just get to enjoy the same pictures and excitement that anyone else would. But if you like space and if you want to learn more about this and this particular issue, planetary.org, check us out. And more broadly, I mean, I think, again, this is something that is a counterpoint to the nihilism, cynicism, and small-mindedness that I believe are kind of the product of, you know, a broad social media, you know, psychological issue that we're all working through. Chris, I will throw the best compliment I can. I loved his book because he talked about this idea of engaging with the sublime. And man, we need that right now. And that's such part of who we are as humans, to feel awe, to feel wonder, to feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. Religion is that for a lot of people, including myself. But this aspect of engaging with space is a part of that too. And you can marvel at the natural world and its immensity. And this is a conduit to that. And there are not many conduits like that in the world these days. And so that's one of the most precious aspects of what we do.
Christopher Quirkinos, last word here, about a minute.
Yes, I'll close with a quote from Carl Sagan, whose scientific career and his career as a public communicator of science still inspires us, and was one of the co-founders of the Planetary Society. And he once said that cutting off fundamental curiosity-driven science is like eating the seed corn. We may have a little more to eat next winter, but what will we plant so we and our children will have enough to get through the winters to come? And that's, I think, a great metaphor for all the things that we've been talking about this morning. not only the practical outcomes of, you know, the direct return of investment in Utah, nearly $400 million of activity because of NASA's budget, but these larger points too, being inspired to understand the universe, being, as I said, a nation that chooses to be driven by curiosity rather than retreating into ignorance.
Good place to end the conversation. We'll be talking about the Trump administration's proposal, a nearly 25% cut to NASA's budget, as well as deep cuts to space technology funding. And we've been talking with Casey Dreyer, Chief of Policy at the Planetary Society. Thank you so much.
It was a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Christopher Kokinos has been with us in studio. He's a Logan-based nature and science writer, professor emeritus of English, and author most recently of Still as Bright, which is a book about the moon. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And let Congress know what you guys think out there.
All right. Yeah, that's you might think it's not powerful, but it is.
It is.
They do note the calls that come in. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.